listening to the Investigative Journal. I'm your host, Greg Szymanski. 2 hours. 2 hours with great interviews all the time. We get into the news behind the scenes that the mainstream media refuses to cover. What a shame. We're going to get deep inside the family, the order, the Illuminati, today for 2 hours. And you got to stay with us from the beginning to the end of this interview. I've been running this series on the feared Illuminati. That word is used, and it started to be used back in the 18th century, I believe. And there's other words. There's other words, the family, the order, for people that are inside this group. So let's not get hung up on just the words. But what this group does is amazing. And as I documented in my series, which is going on now, part three is on today. So if you want to go to Arctic Beacon, get that. And it's talking about Zvali, who was a member of the Illuminati, the family, the order. She's with us as our guest today, and after this break, we're going to find out the whole story from beginning to end about Zvali's involvement, and then about how she decided to get out and what she's doing now. And I might add, it's a great thing what she's doing now, alerting people and also helping many, many people in America understand exactly what this group is all about. So anyway, we'll be back with Zvali on the Investigative Journal. I'm your host, Greg Szymanski. Okay, we're back. It's 8 minutes after the hour, and we're going to get deep inside the Illuminati, the family, the order. We have a guest that was involved with this group, born into it for over 30 years, and her name is Zvali. Zvali, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Well, it's nice to have you here, and I know you don't give radio interviews, and I really want to thank you because I think it really does help the American people understand about this secret organization that you were born into. So I guess before we, I guess we can just start from the beginning and tell us right from the beginning. You were born into this from wealthy parents, and tell us about your training in this group and when you were a young child and then up into your orientation at the Vatican. Go ahead.
That's a pretty broad area, though, Greg. I mean, that could take hours, if you know what I mean.
Yes, but do the, if you could just outline it for us.
Yeah. I mean, I was born in the group. I was born in Germany, came to the U.S. very young, and basically went through all the training that the group, all members of the group do undergo training to different degrees, depending on the role. By the time I was a teenager, I was a youth leader, and by the time I was 22, I became the youngest member of Leadership Council in San Diego County. And at that time, I was a head trainer. I was the sixth trainer. I eventually moved up to the second position.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was 12, I had mentioned with you the ceremony at the Vatican. That they really do make all leadership in the group undergo at some point.
Now, basically, when you were growing up, I remember you told me that you were instilled at a young age. You were born to a very wealthy, well-to-do family. You moved back to the States. You were told at a very young age you were special. You were chosen. Correct?
Well, they tell everyone in the group that they're special and chosen. And, in fact, that's one of the things that made me very cynical when I was older is that, you will never meet a person who's an Illuminati who's not been told and programmed for years that they're special. They're the only one that can do things for, quote-unquote, family. But I was told, yes, I would do great things for family one day. And the reason why, I guess, I can filter some of this with objective view is I know what my role in the group was, and it was over quite a significant number of other people. So I don't evaluate my role or specialness within the group not so much by what I was told, but by what I did.
So you reach the age of 12, and then you're told by your parents you're going to an induction ceremony in the Vatican. Can you tell us how that happened and what occurred at that ceremony when you went there?
Okay. This isn't easy to talk about, as you know. When I was 12, I was flown over to Germany, and I was at what I'll call them the German father's house over there. And there was some preparation for a few days beforehand, and I was told that there would be a very important ceremony, and it was considered a sealing ceremony at that point. And basically, I was told a little bit about what I was expected to do during the ceremony. you know. When we got there, we went to the Vatican. There's underneath the Vatican, there's a large room that I described to you when we talked before. It has 13 catacomb chambers leading into it with, and what they do is they, as you go down these steps into the room, you can see that they're, it's almost circular, and so they're all around it, and they bring out the mummies from the catacombs, and they set them beside each one, and they say that the spirits of the fathers watching over the ceremony. And during the ceremony, there was a large table in the center of the room. It was on top of a huge golden pentagram, and they had a ceremony there. You know, they.
Okay, now how many other children were with you being inducted into the family or the order, as they call it?
There were two other children at that point, and there were several adults too.
Okay.
See, the church also brings in adults to swear their allegiance too. Just so you know, I was told, and I don't know if this is true, but if you're going to rise to a certain position within the Catholic Church hierarchy, you do have to go through that ceremony as well.
Okay, so you're down in this room with your parents weren't present.
No. The German father and the French father were. Yeah.
Okay, and at that point, tell our listeners what you witnessed.
Well, there was a table. It looked like dark glass in the center of the room. I mean, it was made out of stone, but it was very shiny and dark and black. And it may have been something like obsidian or onyx. I'm not sure. You know, I'd have to. That's the only time I've seen stone like that. And it had, like, around the corners, it had, like, these gold, I guess, channels that you know, to collect fluids. And little boys was in the center of the table on drugs. I think he was drugged because he was very quiet. He didn't move or say anything during the ceremony.
This was a little 3 or 4 year old boy.
Yes.
Correct?
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
They continued to do a child sacrifice.
Yes,
right
they
in front
did.
Of you.
They did. Yes. Yeah, I told you about that before. Yeah.
Now, afterwards, unbelievable experience for a youth. I mean, for a 12-year-old. I mean, what went through your mind? I guess when that happened. I mean,
I was terrified. I mean, I was absolutely horrified. I can't describe the terror you feel when you go through something like that.
And do you remember the words they were saying as this was going on?
The man was in scarlet. He was speaking in Latin. And basically he was saying, you know, please accept the sacrifice, you know, on this day. But then, you know, and then he said the sacrifice will seal the ceremony. And then he did it. Again, I was so terrified that have you ever been in a situation where your heart's racing but you can't do anything, and so you're just kinda sitting there and you're kinda like fading in and out?
I can remember as a youth being frightened, but I don't think I've ever
I imagine your heart rate going up to about 220. You can't move, so you're kinda shaking but trying like not to show it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was horrible. And I was thinking inside, I can't wait over, I can't wait. I mean, you don't say this, but inside you're just kind of saying over and over, I can't wait this over, I can't wait this over, I can't wait mm-hmm. till it's over. Afterwards, the man in scarlet, he had a huge golden ring on his hand, and he came over to the center of the room, and he had each of the people that were swearing that day, I had to go forward and kneel before him and kiss his ring and swear my allegiance to the new order, to the new world order, until my death.
Now, and at that point, you are escorted out.
Yes. Yeah. And after the ceremony was all over. I mean, the other people also did theirs as well. You know, they had to swear their allegiance too.
And then they were the same age as you?
The two children were, but there were also three adults that went forward and did the same. And afterwards, we were told, may the same to you or worse occur should you ever break this oath.
So it's basically, imagine at that age, and you weren't really prepped for this, were you? I mean, you were told there was a ceremony, but nothing, you didn't expect anything like this, from what I gathered talking to you.
It was very difficult to go through, just because the sense of horrific oppression down there, too, was the worst. I've gone through some ceremonies in my life, and the Illuminati, you do go through them. But I have to say that in my experience, this was the worst, just because I can't explain the amount of darkness in a room like that, just of pure evil. And unless you've ever been seen oppression, I mean, it's just horrible. It wasn't just what happened, but just, I mean, the oppression. And I'm a Christian now, and I know the difference now between when there's evil present, oppression, or when God's love is present and joy and peace, which is the exact opposite of what was in that room.
Now, you know what I find quite interesting about this? About 25 years ago, I was a reporter and a freelance writer in Rome, and I spent 6 years there. I walked through the Vatican many, many times, hundreds of times, covered the papal addresses, things like that. And during that time, I was there during a Vatican scandal, which involved the church bank and other things, members of the Illuminati, the Freemasons. I was approached by a woman on Via Veneto. I'll never forget this. Rome's a small town, and people knew I was covering stories about the secret societies, things like that, because I had to ask people. Well, this woman came up to me and told me similar stories. She wasn't quite as specific because she couldn't handle it. She would break out crying.
Yeah.
And had tried to commit suicide twice because she couldn't get out of the Illuminati. She was a member, she was, again, born into it, a very wealthy northern Italian family. And she told me basically the same ceremony took place with her. And so when I started talking to you, I wanted to relay that to you and to also relay to my listeners that I heard about this 25 years ago from a woman by the name of Maria and many other people, several other people in Italy that I talked to. I was never able to locate, or really, probably for my own safety, never find out what happened. But again, Svali's corroborating a story that I heard about 25 years ago. We'll get back after this break with this incredible story about a member of the Illuminati who's now out of the group and safe on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Okay, we're back on the Investigative Journal. I'm your host, Greg Szymanski. We're talking to Svali, a member of the family, the Order, the Illuminati for over 30 years. Svali, you leave the induction ceremony. You walk out into the Vatican courtyard, and what do you leave with one of the fathers, I believe. What did he tell you then?
At that point, he just told me to never forget that, you know, he told me that I performed well during the ceremony because I didn't scream or, you know, pass out or anything like that. So he said, you did very well, and he was pleased. And then we went and stayed at a home nearby, a local, it must have been a local person. I didn't know them. We spent the night there before we went back to Germany.
Okay, and what about the other people during the ceremony? How did they handle themselves? Do you remember?
I'm going to say, unfortunately, I'm so... And when you're in that kind of situation, the last thing they're thinking about sometimes is what the other people are doing. I was just so trying to not, like, lose it myself. And that I do know that, I mean, no one screamed or shouted, you know, or anything like that. Everyone was quiet. I think to say dead silence is, unless the person was spoken to, is true. Or unless they had to go forward and kiss the ring.
Let's move on. I think we the question I wanted to ask you, and this is such a wide subject. I've had a chance to talk to you a number of days, and I've done some stories about it. You go back home. You're 12 years old. You said you were schooled into 12 disciplines. So your life begins, and you know now you're in some type of organization that isn't that is very different than what most people experience. But tell us, you know, I guess what I want to do is leave it open to you to begin. I mean, you've written so in-depth on this story. I'm just going to give you the microphone and let you begin and tell the listeners what you think is important about your original training, about the group, and about, you know, many things that I know people want to know about the Illuminati. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, Greg, first I want to say that my purpose in talking about this is not to glorify evil, because there are very wicked people out there, very powerful people. And I don't want to at all magnify their power, but I do want people to know that this is real, that these people exist, that people who say there are people out there that are involved in this activity, it really happened. I also, because I know that there are children being hurt in the group every day, and that's my motivation for coming forward. I don't like giving interviews for obvious reasons. I'm willing this one time to lay aside my thoughts of personal safety because these people need to be stopped. It needs to be stopped.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, go ahead.
And normally children in the group are born into it. While the Illuminati very rarely does outside recruitment, that's not their main method. It's just passed down generationally from father to son and mother to daughters to children until the whole family line is in it. Throughout the centuries, people have tried to escape, but a lot of times they were either poisoned, murdered, or set up to look like a suicide. They don't like it when people leave, and they try to make it very difficult, simply because it looks bad. They go through an enormous amount of training. From the time you're an infant, you undergo indoctrination. And when I say indoctrination, I don't just mean like cult programming so much as watching your parents and seeing what they do. My parents modeled their behavior. To them, the group was very important. So growing up, I saw that three times a week, everything was dropped to attend to the activities. Okay?
Okay.
The training process is designed to help you take on your adult role in the group. The Illuminati covers so many levels, though, too. It goes all the way from what most people think of as like a satanic coven type thing at the very low local level, all the way through. It's a huge, enormous business corporation. At the mid-levels, you have people overseeing finances and administration who are overseeing. I mean, these people are making a lot of money through gun running, through white slavery, prostitution, pornography. They have links and ties to the mafia left and right. And, in fact, the mafia are afraid of them. Yeah. Well, think about it. I mean, you know, but because they know that you don't cross the members of the group. They have a very spiritual orientation. They're not satanic, though. They're Luciferian, which is a difference. But mm-hmm. the ultimate goal of their spiritual philosophy and their steps of discipline is they believe that should you complete all of your training, that you become a god. That is their actual end goal. They believe in the achievement of godhood, of Illuminist philosophy, through different means, through what they call enlightenment or illumination, which is how they got their name.
Mm-hmm.
They're international. In Europe, there's 12 fathers who sit that represent the different nations of Europe. They are very expectantly awaiting he who is to come. And during that ceremony in the Vatican, I on my knees, I had to swear my allegiance to serve he who is to come. They believe.
So, Alec, can you... I have to take a break. We'll continue
sure.
with the massive organization. Your role as a mid-level person in the Illuminati on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Okay, we're back on the Investigate Journal, and I'm talking with Svali. Svali, why don't we just pick it right up where we left off at the break? You were telling us about this hierarchy that starts with 12 fathers. Can you just run that down for us so that people know exactly how this group's organized?
Sure. At the top levels, it's in Rome. That's the center or the heart of the Illuminati. That's where the power base is. And that's why all leadership must swear fealty in Rome, because that's considered the core of the spiritual center of the universe, is how they view it. From there, in Europe, there are 12 fathers, one for each country in Europe. When I was younger, too, I had to also meet with the fathers at one point and kiss their rings and go through another ceremony of allegiance to them as well. There's in the Illuminati, the European fathers, though, rule over what are called the different houses. For instance, if you're from Germany, then you belong to the German house. If you're from France, you belong to the French house. They call them houses. UK, Russia, Poland, Belgium, Spain, Italy, and others. From there, America was considered a mission field for them. And in the 1600s, Pittsburgh became the first port of entry for them, and that's where they first settled. And so that's why it's still considered a spiritual power base for the group on the East Coast in the U.S.
You know, and I did want to mention one thing. A caller or a listener or a reader of your stories sent me an email, said, Greg, check into the reason why President Bush, right after being elected, went to Pittsburgh and talked to a Masonic group there. I found that quite interesting. Go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I mean, it's the spiritual power base for the group. From there, it spread out, of course, to the Atlantic seaboard and then throughout the nation. And while the nation is divided into many regions, multiple regions, seven main regions, the East Coast region has its spiritual power base in Pittsburgh, but the administrative power base is in Alexandria, Virginia. That's where they administer the finances or the day-to-day operations. The West Coast, or the West region, or west of the Mississippi, has its power base in the San Diego area.
And that's where you spent a lot of time, correct?
Yes. I was sent from the Alexandria Council, sent me to San Diego to help them out.
Okay, go ahead.
Let's see. Those are the two, of course, main regions, and then each of those regions are divided into sub-regions. And so then you have your regional council sitting over those and overseeing activities. I mean, if you can think of the structure of a large multinational corporation, that's really how the Illuminati is structured. Then beneath each of the regional councils are your local councils. They call them sister groups or sister, or your local councils, and then you have your local groups under those as well, or what they call the sister groups. So any major metropolitan city could have anywhere from 5 to 15 groups, depending on the size population base.
Now, you were saying that how many people are in this group in America, about, from your estimate of knowing a lot of this stuff? Go ahead.
Pure Illuminati, I'd say about 1%, give or take.
So it's a fairly big organization, correct?
Yes. Oh yeah.
Now their goal, basically, just give us the broad overview goal, and then I want to get into some of these your role in it, and some of these ways that the Illuminati makes money that you learned about. Go ahead.
Yeah. You know, when you say to rule the world, it almost sounds laughable, like, yeah, right, you know. I think people get ideas of, like, thinking in the brain, wanting to rule the world. But really, that is their goal. They believe that they are the intelligent leaders, and they believe that the rest of the world are sheep who need wise. They see themselves as wise leadership, so they believe that their goal is to rule the world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but at the same time, they have ways of doing this. Their main methods of doing so are behind the scenes. They believe in infiltration of the media, of education, and of government. Those are the three areas, and of the financial system. And they've successfully done quite a bit of all four throughout Europe and the U.S., as well as other countries.
Now, you said that you're basically the Illuminati is divided into about six or seven different groups, and everyone is born into a group. Can you outline what those groups are?
Well, no, it's all one group, but it just has different levels. you know.
Yeah, that's what I mean, like the sciences, the government.
The Illuminati is divided into different branches of learning. And these branches include sciences, military, government, leadership, scholarship, and spiritual. Those are the six branches of learning. And while all children need to undergo some training or teaching in each area, as they get older, they begin profiling you from infancy, and they know where your aptitudes and abilities are. Then most people specialize in one branch or possibly two branches of learning.
And you were involved in what branch?
I was heavily involved in sciences, and also to some degree, I did some spiritual as well, but mainly sciences.
Just to backtrack 1 minute, these 12 disciplines, as a child, you were rigorously trained in this, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And what were those disciplines? I mean, you don't have to go through each one of them, but what primarily were you taught?
I think the best way would be to just give you an example of just one type of training that they do.
Okay.
When I was 2 years old, I was left in a room for probably a 24-hour period. When you're that age, it's hard to estimate, but it was a long time. I know that the sun did go around at least once. You know, it wasn't just like a few hours. And at that age, when you're two and you're left completely alone without food and water, you're terrified. And at the end of the time, I was just dying of thirst. I remember I've never been so thirsty in my entire life. And my mother walked into the room, because a lot of times they have the children, you know, or the parents as train the children at these early ages. And there was a table in the middle of the room, and I'm sitting at it, and she sits at it, and she brings me this cold pitcher of water, and she starts pouring it. I said, "Mama, I want a drink of water." And she slapped me out of the chair. And I remember crying, and I'm like, and as I'm crying, and she's drinking the water in front of me, and she leaves. She takes the pitcher of water, and a couple of hours later, she came back in and did the same thing. I said, Mama, I want water. And she slapped me, across the room. And after this had happened about three times, luckily I was bright enough that by the third time she came in, I remember crying violently. I just looked at her. I didn't ask. And after she got up and left with the picture, then a man came into the room. He said, "You did very well that time." And then he gave me a drink of water. And I've always, that was part of the learning not to want stage. And looking back on it, I realize now as an adult that the purpose of that training was to teach me not to recognize my own physiological needs and respond to them, but to look to outside people to tell me what I wanted or needed.
You told me that you led kind of a dual life in the Illuminati. I mean, that's basically how they function. They have a day job, and then at nighttime you're quite busy sometimes with the cult's activities, correct?
Yes.
Okay. What I wanted to get into, you were talking about these groups. I remember I mentioned to you, you said you had meetings three times a week, and I said, well, what about if I wanted to go and visit? Maybe do a story about them. What would happen, or how would I be able to find one of these meetings that were going on where in your area of Escondido?
Well, no, because of the security measures. And A, you really don't want to show up unannounced at a meeting if you could get through their security, because chances are you would never make it out alive. Let's just say that a sudden auto accident would occur and be reporting the papers, unfortunate accident, man accidentally runs into tree. But the security that they have during group meetings is so intense that it would be very difficult. They have security at the 1 mile perimeter, the 3 mile perimeter, and the 5 mile perimeter. They have three people assigned, usually one's like up in a tree where you can't see them, at the 5 mile perimeter, and then you have one person who's standing who looks like a security guard for this state, because these are often large, wealthy states, which is appropriate, and he's dressed in the uniform. And the third person standing hidden behind a tree. As cars come through and they come through the gates, because remember these are gated estates.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not someone on their approved license checklist, they'll stop the car and they say, it's just like at a military installation. They'll say, can I help you? Are you lost? Their goal is to delay the person. Now, if a person's saying, oh, is this blah, 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 and they're just asking directions, they'll give them directions, they'll be very pleasant and send them on their way to where they're supposed to be going. But if they are acting as if they want to go further into the state, and this is not an okay person, then the person, they will say, all right, well, you can say he's not expecting you. That's a code word. That tells a person either behind, up in the tree, hidden, or else behind, hidden further back. They radio ahead and they say, unexpected visitor. At that point, everyone has been trained to pick up and leave immediately within 5 minutes. No traces of the activity.
So this is some of the methods they go through so you don't get caught. I know that you wrote an article about why the occult doesn't get caught, and that's pretty specific. I mean, you have so much stuff here, and we can't get into it all in 2 hours, so please pick and choose what you think is most important. But I found that to be interesting, why the cult doesn't get caught. Is there anything in just a brief time you could explain to us that?
Well, their security, their money, their influence. Some of these people even own newspapers. Imagine trying to get an article published, disclosing. There's a lot of reasons why they don't get caught, because that's the first thing people ask. But then my next question is, how many child pornographers are out there that the police have been chasing for years and have never found or caught?
Correct.
And they're not even members of a secret organization. They're just trying to hide, you know?
So
Okay.
Yeah. You are a mid-level person in this organization, a head trainer. We're going to get into those specifics in the next hour. But, you know, what did you learn about the infiltration of this group into all of our different areas of government, media? They're basically at the high levels of most of our financial institutions also, correct?
Yeah.
And that is a great way to pursue their goal. And I guess I got to ask you this. How come things are moving a little bit faster in America now? I remember back in the 80s when I was confronted with this, when I came back home, I didn't really see this kind of New World Order movement, all this different symbolism that you see now. What is going on, just for our listeners, right now? Why are things stepped up since 9/11?
I believe it's because they can see the fulfillment of their goal. I'm going to sound very cynical now, and okay, please forgive me for this, but see, their goal is to rule the world, and personally, I believe that they do. It's just not open yet. Mm-hmm. And they see now preparing people for when they disclose it themselves openly. Does that mean that they can't be stopped? I believe they could. I believe it'd take a miracle because of the amount of infiltration I've seen at all levels of society and the world. These people and women have a lot of money. They have a lot of influence. And your average person has no idea of how much that is going on behind the scenes that no one understands. But with that said, so basically, I mean, I think that they're already there. They just aren't open. These people just don't know what they're doing. If they did, I think the average person would be horrified to know how much is going on behind the scenes that people really don't know.
Yeah, and the point of this interview, one, I had two goals interview.
But I don't want to sound despairing, because I'm also a strong Christian. I have faith in God, and I believe that through prayer and through people knowing that, I mean, I would like them to be stopped. I just don't know at this point, how do you take on the financial institutions of the world, the major oil enterprises of the world, you know? That's the question.
Yeah, it's a difficult question. Now, you're in the mid-level of this group. You worked your way up to a head trainer, correct?
Yeah.
Now, what did you learn? Before we get into the specifics, you outline in some of your writings the big money-making, the ways this group makes its money. Can you go over and outline some of those methods?
Again, if you can think of an illegal activity, they're probably involved at some point, maybe not overtly at the point of where the actual money is first changing hands. But when you have child pornography, prostitution, white slavery, gun running, gambling, then at some point where the money's changing hands, about four, buffered by about four layers of people, there's going to be probably someone from the Illuminati involved at that point. These guys have their fingers in everything.
Now, go ahead.
But they also use legitimate means. They launder their money. I mean, when you have a lot of money, you have to do something with it. And so what they'll call, they, I mean, these men don't come in and say, hi, I'm a member of the Illuminati, and I want to, like, run your bank. But what they'll do is they'll quietly come in and become a quiet investor, start buying up shares. And over a period of maybe almost a lifetime, they will get a controlling interest in the bank. Or else become a very, you know, and maybe in their son's lifetime. Because that's the other thing about the Illuminati. The Illuminati do not see it as it must happen now in my lifetime. These people have goals that last for a century. Or two centuries. They're very, very patient.
And that's why the specific training of the children is so important, correct?
Yes. Yes. It's to teach you patience. Everyone mm-hmm. knows growing up in the group, they know that we may not see the coming order disclosed or open or revealed in our lifetime, but our children or our grandchildren may. So they will spend their entire life trying to bring about the goals of the organization.
Incredible. So now you're in the mid-level. And I can see now where they use the programming techniques, the different mind control techniques.
Yeah.
We had a minute before the break. Just kind of what our interest about how you, what your specific role was.
Well, they did a lot of what you might call human experimentation. And they had a lot of research protocols going on. So one thing I did was to supervise the research going on. I was teaching the younger trainers and head trainers how to do things more efficiently, how to do their job well, but also reviewing their research reports for errors or problems. Eventually, I became kind of a consultant. If a problem occurred or if they didn't know how to install something or if they needed assistance, I would help them with problem solving as well.
Okay, Zvali, I'm going to have to take a break. We'll be back in 3 minutes. We'll continue on
sure.
the Republic Broadcasting Network. Okay, we're back on the Investigative Journal. I got a short 4 minute segment here, then we'll take a break and come back with Zvali for a whole other hour. We're talking about some of the jobs in the Illuminati, the practical daily jobs that these members of this group who are infiltrated in America heavily take what they do. Now, one thing I find interesting, Zvali, is, you know, in the media, you know, I'm not going to name names or anything else. I don't have any specific information. But I find it interesting, doing some background checks, and a lot of the top media people in our country, they all come from these very wealthy families. And, you know, that's not the typical MO for a journalist. A journalist is somebody, you know, grows up on the street, wants to talk to people. I mean, I can think of Jimmy Breslin, guys who never went to college, didn't know how to type, and just got in there and took their tie off and started writing stories. But, you know, as you look at the media now, these are all these silver spoon kids growing up with silver spoons. I find that quite interesting. How deeply infiltrated, from your knowledge, are they in our media?
Wow. Pretty. I mean, I do know fairly deeply. I remember that when I was in San Diego on leadership council during meetings, they would laugh about how people had no idea of how much they were being influenced and didn't even know it. They found that kind of amusing, which is, I mean, that's the mindset of people in the group, though. They're like, the sheep have no idea that they're being led by the moon. And
right.
they find it amusing because they show it as evidence of this. I'm sorry. I mean, I'm just describing what they say. I don't agree with it now, but they saw it as evidence of the stupidity of the average person, that they have no idea. I'm not saying that every news story or every newscaster is a member of the group, by no means. But they specifically do teach and train and educate children to show an aptitude for the media, because they want that. And if a person has a bright, charismatic personality and presents well, then that's just that child will go into that if they have the verbal communication and other skills required.
Correct. And, you know, that could explain why a lot of our stories really never get covered outside of the influence they have financially and the ownership of the media.
Absolutely not by coincidence.
What's that?
Not at all a coincidence.
Yes, I mean, that's a good idea why, folks, you're not getting the news from those outlets. I mean, we have, not only in our government, it explains, you know, a lot of things. I mean, why, look at the war in Iraq. Look at the evidence there that shows that it was wrong. Look at what they're doing in Iran right now. I mean, it's incredible, all this stuff. It's pretty obvious, people, you know, there's something behind it. Zvali is here trying to explain this organization from her knowledge, and it's quite a story. I know this idea, you were involved as a trainer, mind programming. I mean, this is just, I'm looking at some of the chapters in a book you have yet to publish. I mean, we're talking about brainwave, color control, metal, jewel programming, programming linked to stories and movies. I mean, it goes suicidal program. And just a minute here before I break, can you kind of break down what you learned about the importance? Well, oh, we got to take a break, Zvali. Sorry. We're going to do that quickly. Then we'll get back to you. We're talking to Zvali regarding her role as a head trainer in the Illuminati and the American Illuminati. We'll be back on the Republic Broadcasting Network in 2 minutes. Okay, we're back on the Investigative Journal. One more hour, we're talking to Zvali, and she was a head trainer in the Illuminati. Zvali, what type of programming do they actually teach you, and how do you learn these different techniques?
Well, you're taught from childhood on. My training in how to be a programmer was very young. I was mentored by another programmer at the age of five by a doctor at George Washington University. And he not only did he do the programming on me, but also taught me how to do it to others. The types of programming, again, that could be a whole 10-hour segment to go into depth. Just briefly, from the time a child's an infant, all through their life, basically, they're tested, they're profiled. The trainers can create a psychological profile, and then they update it frequently. And basically, they're trying to install in the child the ability to obey, loyalty to the group, and the ability to do their job within the group. Now, those jobs vary in complexity. I mean, you may have, on one side, a child trained to be a prostitute. On the other end, you may have a child trained to become a governmental figure, which is a lot more complex programming. But as long as the loyalty to the group is instilled first, and that's the first and foremost programming always installed, then no matter what their eventual role is, they will remain loyal, and that becomes their first loyalty. Whatever nation, whatever their public role in life is, their first and foremost loyalty will be to the group and to serve its goals. Whether they know, a lot of times the goal there too is to be able to help the child create that complete division between their day role and their night role. So a pleasant, charming, wonderful, kind person in the daytime could be an absolutely cold, ruthless person at night. Or during the day, you know, it's also during the day they do it. They may, you may have a housewife with children who goes out and completes a courier job for the group. And no one would ever suspect her. This frumpy-looking old housewife with a baby in a car seat is actually carrying some valuable documents. Or, again, I mean, the first and foremost, though, is they want to instill loyalty. And they want to discourage people from questioning orders. They really don't want you questioning that, and they want you to obey their directives. And should people show signs of not doing that, then they go in for tips. Actually, people are being programmed all through their life. We used to call them tune-ups, you know. And it's a lifelong process for members of the group.
So, you know, we have a minute here before our break, and then we'll get back and get in-depth in some of these areas. But what went wrong with you? I mean, the dropout rate probably is very low, considering the number of, considering the training. But what went wrong with you? They somehow missed something.
When I was very young, I absolutely believed in the goals of it. You never saw a more loyal group member. I thought that they were saving the world. I thought that we were doing a wonderful thing. But the older I got, I started to see the methods that were being used were so wrong, and that the end did not justify the means. I became increasingly cynical, partly because I saw what I was doing to people. I was lying to them. I was manipulating them. I was telling them things that weren't true. And I remember questioning this, thinking, I was told lies as a child too then. I was manipulated. And finally, wow. You know, things like that, you start to question as an adult the things you believe.
Okay. All right, we're gonna take a break, Savali. We'll be back in 3 minutes on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Okay, we're back on the Investigative Journal. Savali, I wanted to ask you a question before we get into how you finally left the group and what happened to you afterwards, your life now. Tell us, you wrote an article, it was kind of interesting, A Day in the Life of a Trainer for the Illuminati. Tell us kind of what you went through in a normal day in your role at the Illuminati. Go ahead.
Okay. Basically, I would get up. At the time that I described in that article, I was teaching at a Christian school. And so I would get up, I would get my two children, I dressed ready for school, look just like a normal mom, you know, go through the day, come home, you know, we'd have little friends over and play and stuff like that. And then have dinner, you know, I was a good mom. I was your average American housewife, I mean, on the surface.
Okay.
But underneath the surface, then my husband and I would remind each other on nights when there was a meeting. And then what we would do is when we go to sleep, I have programming in place that would allow me to wake up within 10 minutes of a specified time. So if I knew there was a meeting that night, I would wake up 10 minutes before it was time to, you know, get ready and go. A lot of times we would even go to bed with our clothes on. And I never thought that was abnormal, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I thought everyone went to bed with their clothes on. Didn't even question it, you know, on nights when we had meetings. I thought, oh, it's warmer.
Okay.
And then we'd get up and go and drive to the meeting. And I was also very involved in military in San Diego. In fact, the group has a lot of military orientation. And so a lot of times I would take the kids to their area. There's an area where the kids would go and change. They had a room, and we would have, like, baskets of clothes, and we'd change our clothing. You'd take out your clothing, you know, it had your name on it, and put on your uniform or whatever you wore that night. And the kids would wear these little miniature military uniforms. And then they would go out and do their training exercises. They were learning how to march, how to shoot. All kids in Illuminati know, at least in that area, know how to, like, take apart a gun, put it together, and shoot with deadly accuracy by the age of 8 years old. Martial arts, there's a lot of martial arts training. Sometimes that helps supervise that or fill in if a military trainer was, because, you know, you had to know how to do it. Everyone had to be, there's a lot of cross training. But most of the time I supervised the training. I would be working on implementing programming or what we call tuning up, you know, reinforcing previously installed programming in adults. At that point, I was normally supervising the younger trainers. They would be doing it, and I would be there watching and making sure they did it correctly. I would be also evaluating, like, whether sometimes every once in a while we'd be working on something that was somewhat experimental, and then I would be taking a more active role, assessing the person's responses to the new protocol, recording it, and if there was any difference between established parameters for that protocol or expected responses, you know, I'd be flagging that.
Give me an example of someone that you were working on. What? How would they be introduced? What would be the reason? Are they in the military? What is? How does someone get sent to you?
No, these were all members of the group.
Oh, okay.
In fact, I can tell you that in San Diego, 20% of the active members of the group were active military.
Okay.
Okay, and think military intelligence. Think high-ranking officials, colonels, you know, commanders. My ex-husband was a lieutenant commander in the Navy, getting ready to become a commander, okay?
All right.
These are not stupid people.
So you're basically involved in working on the programming of the members involved, too.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
No. We didn't program people that weren't members of the group. You cannot install significantly traumatic mind control programming in a person who is not a member of the group. Now, there are certain... what you can do is what we call passive programming, which is basically through media means. You know, you can set if someone's watching a television program, they go immediately into alpha state. Everyone in the group, I mean, even the baby in the group knows that because these people are very much into behavioral psychology. And that's a trance state almost, a very relaxed state where messages can be implemented. And that's why I very strongly suggest people be very careful about the TV shows they watch. That's all I'll say about that. But no, you cannot take an adult who's not a member of the group and do what we did to them. They would go psychotic or they wouldn't survive it, probably. They wouldn't be able to psychologically handle it.
Tell us some examples of what you were doing, program techniques.
Sometimes it would involve, normally it would start with a hypnotic induction. Or even sometimes we'd inject the medication. A lot of times, especially young children, have a lot of fear when they're going into programming, but adults did too. We want them to relax. We'd give them a very short-acting medication to relax them. We would then invoke a hypnotic state in them. We would then, if it's an older person, I'd be checking the codes already installed. If I was getting ready to install programming in a young child, I would tell them, explain to them very patiently exactly the behavior expected. I'd say, I want you to do this and this and this. I'd break it up into steps, and I'd say, first we're going to practice this. I would show the child what I want them to do. I'd model it. I would then tell the child, do it. The child would then do it. Okay. But normally they won't do it well the first time, so she or he would get shocked. That was called, because the group very much uses what they call positive and negative reinforcement. Okay, if the child did not do it perfectly the first time, they're shocked. That's the negative reinforcement. Then I'd say, do it again. They would show me the behavior. Now, at this point, we start associating the behavior with an external stimulus or cue, too. Now, a lot of times the child is, if this is a behavior, though, that we want associated with a specific code, the child will often have been traumatized very heavily first to create a fragmentation in their personality. And then the behavior and the associated cue are given. Like, you might hear a tone like, bing, bing, bing. All right, I want you to do this. Bing, bing, bing. The child hears the tone, they get up, and they do the behavior. Once they can perform it perfectly, they're rewarded with praise, good job, or a hug. Children like hugs or something like that. Then you do it over and over and over. That's why trainers have to be very patient people. Because then maybe after the child's done it 50 times, when they hear the cue, they get up, they do it. It's not even a conscious, it's reflexive. At that point, it's considered installed. For very, very important programming, I'm talking about like end-level assassin programming, because we did train people how to assassinate people, and that's a whole other topic that I don't want to go into here.
Okay.
We would then do a ritual to seal the programming afterwards. Okay.
You know something, I was just looking at some of your articles. One was Christmas in the Cult, just to get off on a different subject here.
Sure.
And you say this is quite different for you when you were growing up than it is for most children. Can you just kind of briefly tell us what you meant by that?
Yeah. We had trees and presents and things like that. But for most children, Christmas is just happy time, you know, lots of presents. But in the group, some very high ceremonies that are celebrated. Many times I flew to Germany, and there was no Santa Claus. They had a figure called Father Yule, who is...
Mm-hmm.
who represents Christmas there, but he is not the kind of benevolent Santa that you see here. This is a man with a golden scepter dressed in a white robe and a golden sash around, and I was once at the German father's house where there was a gathering of children and adults, and Father Yule was present, and he raises the scepter and basically strikes down the child in front of everyone.
Oh, my God.
I know.
Strikes down
know,
the child?
Yes, he struck down the child with his scepter, and that is not what you call a happy Christmas, you know.
No.
Now, at the same time, yes, we did have tree and, you know, and fruitcake and all that and decorate the house, but there's another side to Christmas.
I'm just listening and I just can't believe, you know, we got leaders in our country that have probably gone through this kind of stuff. I mean, it's just incredible, this group. I mean, I know they've been around for a long, long time, thousands of years, and gone through. Came here, George Washington was a 33rd degree Mason, and we go on. The question, you know, I want you to understand what, just from my point of view, I just wonder how, you know, you write a story, the end of the Illumina. How do we get rid of these people? I know you're out of it. You couldn't take it anymore, but you think we can inspire more mid-level people to just leave like you, so they have no one to do this kind of insidious, crazy programming and lifestyle? What do you think?
Well, I believe that as strongly as a Christian, that it's a spiritual warfare as well as a emotional and psychological warfare. I believe that by the grace of God. But I will also say that when I was in the group, a lot of the members are not happy. You will have people in the group that are there because they love it, because they believe in the goals, they're totally dedicated. But to be honest, I knew as many people who would have left in a minute if they thought that they could get out and make it.
You know, about your husband, to break in and go back to that, do they marry you to somebody in the group, or is that forced on you?
No, in the group, marriages are always arranged, in my experience. In my 38 years in the group, I never knew of a couple in the Illuminati that did not have an arranged marriage.
Let me just mention a couple that I suspect. Clinton and Bill and Hillary.
Oh, well, yeah. Yes, definitely.
Yes, Bill. Go ahead.
Yeah. And a lot of times these marriages are arranged for compatibility, but also for bloodlines, to bring the right bloodlines together.
Okay, good. We're going to be back in 3 minutes. I want to continue this, and then we're going to get into Zvali's life after the Illuminati on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Okay, well, we're back on the Investigative Journal. I'm your host, Greg Szymanski. And let me tell you, as an interviewer and someone who has researched the Illuminati for a long time, it started way back when I was a young reporter in Rome. It's a whole different ballgame when you're actually talking to someone with experiences like this. It takes it out of that realm of what is quasi-fiction fact into the realm of reality, and it's really shocking. And I'll be honest with you, this is a story that, folks, you have to listen to, because this is going on in our country. All the things you're seeing regarding our rights being taken away, the police state, the war in Iraq, 9/11, all these things have to do with this powerful group. And Zvali, you know, we're talking about mid-level people, then we're going to talk about some of the lower-level people. I'm interested who they are. But I imagine a lot of these, you said they weren't happy, but a lot of them probably stay because it's very, I mean, it's a very very lucrative way to live, I imagine, you're from wealthy families.
Oh, yeah. In fact, and that's the main thing, that's one of the factors that keeps people in. The reason more people don't leave is because leaving means giving up your husband, your children, your entire family on both sides, your money. And basically, for a lot of people leaving the group, it means giving up everything and starting out penniless and alone. And not only that, but then you're combating internal programming to recontact, to go back, to be loyal, to be a good member.
Mm-hmm.
And I've known many people that have tried to leave and went back because they just couldn't take it.
Do you want to take a phone call right now to break it up?
Sure.
Okay, I have Marilyn in California. You're on the Investigative Journal, Marilyn.
Yes, I've been just sort of caught part of this. I lost part of it. I'm listening on the Internet, but I didn't quite catch it. How did this woman become involved in this Illuminati training?
Go ahead. Can you explain that, Zvali?
Yeah, I was taught it from early childhood. I was mentored into it. Trainers in the group are mentored. You work with older adults, and they show you, and you are given increasing responsibility. Until by the time you're in your teens, you are basically doing adult training responsibilities. You've been taught for years.
Your parents put you in it, or?
Yes, they were members.
Oh, I see. So it comes down through the parent, one parent to another.
Yeah, or from both.
Are they private schools?
You what?
Are these private schools?
Well, when my children were schooled at private Christian schools, they were all Illuminati.
Oh, okay. You're saying that the Christian schools are Illuminati?
Some of them are. Not all, but some. No, the ones that my children were in were specifically. But, no, there's a lot of good Christian schools that have nothing to do with the group, but some can be. Now, I went to a public school, but what's interesting is out of three public schools I went to as a young child, two have burned down. So there's no access to any school records.
I'll be darned.
Marilyn, just to get you up to speed, you're born into this, then you're trained as a young child, you go through an induction ceremony in the Vatican, and this is going on with 1-2% of our population, according to Zvali, very serious in all levels, government and everything else. Go ahead, Marilyn, you have another question.
Yeah, when you say the Vatican, now that is not a Christian religion. Okay, so I mean, I'm a Christian. But we do not look at Catholics as a Christian religion. We look at them as the precursor of the New World religion. So,
if I may just break in, I grew up a Catholic. I don't get involved in the splicing of the religions. I'm basically stating that when I started researching the Illuminati as a reporter in Rome, and I realized there was a bad portion of the church, I looked at it. I had to deal with the evil and the good. And so that's the way I reconciled it, the evil within the Catholic Church at the high level of the Vatican, which seeps down into many, many areas. Go ahead.
Okay, well, I won't argue that point. I don't agree with it. But it sounds like you have become possibly born again to get out of this. Could I be correct in that?
Yes, Marilyn, very much. Now, first, I do want to say I am not slamming the Catholic Church or the average Catholic. I have many good friends that are Catholics, that are strong Christians. I became a Christian, and that's the only way I could get out. But just so you know, though, too, a lot of card-carrying Illuminists, well, we don't really carry cards, but I'm using that term.
Yes.
Are members of the Baptist Church, are members of Pentecostal churches. In fact, I was on a worship team for a Wesleyan church in San Diego in my day life. Okay?
Okay. I'm just very, very confused. I mean, I think this is interesting, and as far, you know, many people say that the Catholic Church will be the forerunner of the New World Religion. There's some very good books out. In fact, I think you may have interviewed one of these men, the Grand Plan Design, John Daniel.
Uh-huh.
Do you remember that?
Okay, but the average Catholic has no idea of what's going on in the Vatican.
Yeah. I think that's interesting that the average Catholic would not know what's going on. That's just my take on it.
Well, I'll tell you something. As an average Catholic going to Rome my first time in 1980, I didn't know what was going on, and I grew up as a Catholic, went to Notre Dame High School. It was quite a learning experience for me.
Why do Catholics, when they find out how evil the church is, stay in it? I mean, do they really... Why would they want to stay in it? That's what bothers me. I know some good people that are like that, and I don't get it.
Well, that, the only answer, there's I don't know. I mean, there are many Catholics that aren't actively practicing.
Anyway,
we'll leave that for another time. Thanks a lot, Marilyn. We'll be back on the Investigative Journal in 3 minutes with Zvali. Okay, they're not going to get me, that's for sure. My house is anti-illuminated. It's not going to happen, folks. And, just to end that, Svali, before I get back to you, just to end that conversation we had with Marilyn about Catholicism, I look back and I really thank my dad. And I do it in kind of a way, I'm just thinking about it now. I didn't know what the church was about, but, something strange did happen when I was young. My mom died, and I was 10 years old. My brother was 6 months old at the time. She died of leukemia. It was a very, very tragic affair. It left my dad and me and my brother alone. And I remember my dad literally took a priest, a head Monsignor in our parish, and it was, I'll even tell you where, St. John Brebeuf, right outside of Chicago. And this man came into our house, I'll never forget it, and said that he was going to put me and my little brother in an orphanage. And my dad literally picked him up and threw him out the door, literally. And from that point on, my dad never went back to church again. My brother never went to a Catholic school. I, of course, asked if I could finish only because I had friends there. But, who knows what would have happened, looking back on what's the craziness that goes on in the church. But anyways, while you were talking about... something, these people that do not want to get out because of the financial ties. But let's go back when you were in the Illuminati, and how did this happen? How did you finally leave? And tell us this whole story about you leaving the Illuminati. We haven't touched on that yet.
Sure. Well, I do want to say one thing that I agreed with Marilyn on. Without faith in God, I couldn't have done it, because I became a Christian, and that was for me revolutionary, because it made me question again more of what I was being taught or had believed all my life. I began to realize that what I was doing was wrong. I became increasingly cynical. And I also then started standing up to the head trainer in the county who despised me, because he would do things that were just blatantly cruel for no reason whatsoever. I'd say, "You're wrong." Well, people don't like that. And he took it out on me in a lot of horrible ways. But I finally made the decision to run. I ran to another state, because I knew that my chances of getting out while still staying in that area with people I knew, surrounded by people who were in the group, was not going to be very good. So I went to another state.
You had to leave your family and everything, right?
Everything. Well, my children were with their grandparents, and at that point, I thought that was better than them being with my husband. And I was going to go get my kids. But my husband then called, and he said, "I want to reunite with you." And I said, "Okay, that's wonderful." And I said, "But you have to get help. You have to get some treatment, because we can't go on. You've got to get out of the group." And he said, "Okay." He said, "I'll pick up the kids and meet you in a week." So, you know, the day before he called, said, "I'll be there tomorrow, blah, blah, blah." And so I was excited, thinking, "Oh, he's getting out. That's wonderful." Instead, he had gotten the kids several days before. He was lying to me. I didn't know it. I'd gone to a judge, and the day that he was supposed to arrive, there was a knock on my door. It was the policeman serving me divorce papers and mm-hmm. also a restraining order saying that I could not come within 100 yards of my husband or my children. And at that point, I felt slightly punished for leaving the group. I fought that, and I fought for 4 years with a court system that said that things like this didn't occur, because my husband would go into court and say, "This woman's psychotic. She's making it all up. There's no way. Ha, ha, ha. This stuff doesn't happen this day and age." And the judge would say, "You're right." Slam. Full custody to the father. And I had to have supervised visitation for 4 years with my own children, because I was considered a kidnap risk. But through a lot of prayer, I had my whole church praying for me here in Texas. And through what I believe are a series of miracles, my children were finally allowed unsupervised visitation with me after 4 years. And during that time, I said to my daughter, who was 14, I said, "I want so badly for you to get out." And she looks at me and she starts going, "Oh, you shouldn't have said that, Mom. You shouldn't have said that, Mom." You know, she just freaked out. She just totally lost it. And I realized it was her mm-hmm. programming cycling, because she was just terrified. You know, she's like, "Why'd you say that? Why'd you say that?" You know, and I said, it's okay, honey, calm down. And then finally, she was just shaking. And then finally she said, "Well, I don't want to go back and get hurt." And then I said, "You don't have to." And at that point, I faced federal prison, but I called my ex and I said, I will not let those children go back and get hurt again. And he flew out to get them. And he could have put me in prison at the time, because I was breaking the custody visitation. And you know how strong the courts are on that? Mm-hmm. And I said to him, I said, "Please, my daughter and son said, we don't want to go back, Dad. We don't want to get hurt. We don't want to do this anymore." And he looked at them and he said, "I want to go think about it." And so he went home. And I was praying for him at the time. And then that night he called me and he says, oh my God. And I said, "What?" He said, "We've got to get out. We've got to get out." And I'm like, "Yes, you do." And he made the decision to get out. At that point, he went to a notary public. He gave me, and he did a legal document, gave me full custody of my children. And then he said he was so sorry for it. He put me through the HELL. He put me through for years.
Now, have you had any reprisals from anybody in the group since you leaving, or any warnings to
yes.
get quiet or
oh,
anything
yeah.
like
oh,
that?
Yeah, of course. I mean, and there's one time when I did write one article that named some specific dates and times, and I got hurt afterwards, and it made me very cautious. And that's why I don't give a lot of radio interviews, and why I don't do a lot of this. That's one reason why.
I appreciate this because, you know, the number of people you're going to help by maybe waking up the American people what's really going on. Sometimes it's you can wake up many more people by a person like you than talking about 100 million different generalities. Let me take a call. Chris in Washington, you're on the Investigative Journal.
Hi. Smalley, I just want to say how much I appreciate your bravery in presenting this information in the way that you are. I've read your website recently. And my question is very simple. Based on the information that you're presenting, I'm wondering what timeline the organization of the larger family that you're describing has for implementing the New World Order.
Okay. I was told it would occur during my generation. I was told that by the year 2050 that they would be revealed. Now, again, their timelines change, though. In fact, I think jokingly referred to them as being like the Soviet Union because, you know, how they had their 5 and 10 year plans and then things always got changed. In my own lifetime, I saw several different timelines for things that were supposed to occur change. But as Greg noted, I've also heard of from different people that actually there's a huge push in the last few years. It's like, it's close, let's make things happen more quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't begin to guess whether that's an accurate timeline or not. I know what I was told.
I have a follow-up question, and that's it, and this will be it for me. I have recently, against my own resistance to doing so, started to investigate fringe matters, if you will. Among them, the upcoming date on the Mayan calendar of 2012.
Uh-huh.
And as I've done this research, it's I've allowed myself just to be open to this information without believing anything I'm reading. And one of the ideas that's presenting itself is that around 2012, not just according to the Mayan calendar, but many other theories out there, that we will be undergoing, as a planet, a revolutionary shift, if you will, of some kind or another. And I'm wondering in the back of my mind if there might be any kind of race against the clock on that scale, if you will, especially if we're talking about a potential spiritual warfare, using your words, in play here. Do you see a possible relation there?
Yes, I do. And 2012 is an important year, but again, I was not told that the final revealing would occur then. But I believe that what will happen is there will be events taking place that will help to set the stage.
Okay.
There's going to be, I was told, and again, I'm telling you what I was told while a member of the group, so please take it with a grain of salt, because as I know, these people aren't always honest or trustworthy. They are deceptive, but I was told that there would be enormous economic collapse prior to the revealing, that basically the stock market would destabilize.
Well, that appears to be already happening.
And I was told it would make the Great Depression look like Sunday school. And at that time, they're going to really be manipulating finances to bring about chaos, confusion, warfare, and then, I don't like to be so negative. But I am telling you what I was taught when I was in the group. You know.
Well, I appreciate it.
Yeah,
and I'm sure we all do.
Yeah, and so
you're a great voice.
Well, thank you. I mean, I appreciate that very much. But out of this chaos, they said would come order. See, the group believes that out of chaos comes order.
As far as I'm concerned, I'd rather Svali, these guys want to bring down this country financially, whatever way possible. And right now, your voice is important in that. And Chris, I really appreciate you saying that because we want to stop these guys. I mean, come on. Let's get the American people to get together and just put an end to this. We have a powerful group in numbers. We may not have the money, but we can take it back. And I don't want to be bullied by these kind of people. That's my feeling.
Yeah.
Let me take another call. Harper in Canada.
Can you hear
Harper?
Me? Hi.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, great.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hey, great, thanks, Greg. And Savali, I read your expose when it came out on Suite101.com a few years ago, mm-hmm. and I always wondered what happened to you because you vanished from Suite 101. So it's great to hear about you. A couple quick questions. I'll make them real fast. First is the term Moriah Conquering Wind. I'd never heard that before or since I read it in your expose. I wondered if you could elaborate on that term a little bit. I also wanted to ask you if this cult, as far as you know, claims to or believes to derive any of its heritage from Atlantis or any other lost civilization. Okay?
I'm not sure about the reference to Moriah you're describing, because Moriah but I can certainly address the second question. The Illuminati completely believe that Atlantis is real. They teach it to their children as part of the oral history. They believe it was one of the greatest civilizations that ever existed and one of the most advanced. And what they teach, their take on it is that Atlantis was a great race of highly intelligent people who had a highly advanced state and who were highly enlightened. And what they teach the Illuminati children is that then this prophet of the enemy, who is the prophet of God, came and foretold their destruction if they didn't change their ways. Because they were definitely occultists. They were Luciferian, not Atlantis. I mean, that was the religion. And, in fact, a lot of the advances that Atlantis enjoyed was passed down to them through supernatural means, is what I'll say. And so... So they laughed at the prophet, and they killed him. And I guess sometime afterwards, we were taught that a few inhabitants escaped, but tragically the great city was lost. And the Illuminati to this day mourn the loss of Atlantis because they feel that the few survivors that left were among the great people who helped found the. What you would call the precursors of Illuminism.
One more quick question, if I may. And I wanted to ask you if you have any reason to believe that the people, men and or women, at the top of the pyramid, so to speak, practice a kind of magic where they are kind of skipping through time, in other words.
Oh, yes.
Spirit leaving one body and coming and being born into another one and therefore, living through time.
All the time. In fact, see, now I didn't go there in this interview because you start sounding wacko if you start discussing things like that. But in the spiritual side, they very much teach things like time travel, traveling out of body, psychic battling, things like that, things that cannot be explained by logic. And I saw things that I cannot explain through human intellect or reasoning that were highly supernatural and involve all of that. And more.
Okay, great. It's a pleasure to speak with you, man. God bless
you. Okay, thanks, Harper.
Hey,
I think we have Dave Wilcox called in. I think you know Dave through emails.
Yes.
Zvali. Dave, you want to say hello and you have a question for Zvali?
Sure. Zvali, it's great to have you on the air. I'm really glad you decided to do it, so thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Dave. It's good to talk with you.
Yeah. I feel like you're an old friend. I've been reading your stuff for so long, and you share so willingly and openly about yourself. It's a real honor to be able to speak with you in person like this.
Well,
go ahead. Well, Dave, you may have something you want to say to Zvali. Go ahead.
Sure.
Question?
I think one of the things I'd really like to have covered here is you shared with me in an email recently about these stages of enlightenment that they try to guide people through.
Yes.
And I would like you to try to sketch out for people how the behavioral conditioning that's coming through the media and the movies and so forth might have affected them. In other words, what personality characteristics would you see in a person when they have been influenced by these teachings? How would the average person who's not really a bad person start to be leaning if the Illuminati teachings were actually having an effect on them? What would they be like? What would start happening?
Well, again, as I said, the average person is not going to be a member of the group, so the influence would be much less. But the media, I believe that, well, in fact, I know that some of the media that we're seeing nowadays is specifically targeted towards teaching people their philosophy or goals. All you have to do is watch a children's cartoons on Saturday morning, and almost across the board, you'll see morphing, power battles, occult, And that's intentional. Movies coming out. But basically, if a person's being influenced by their teachings, that person will learn to not trust their own instincts, their own feelings, their own body, their own perceptions. They'll be looking outside for guidance. Second of all, they will be leaning towards a heavily occultic worldview. That leaning upon the occult is very heavily encouraged. All you have to do is watch Harry Potter. Not to slam one of the most popular movies, but yes, I mean, or The Matrix. If you want to know pure and luminous philosophy, The Matrix shows it.
Oh, constantly, yeah.
The entire...
With Morpheus being broken down with the injections, and they said that it's like hacking a computer.
Yeah.
Okay, exactly. We're going to take a break. We'll come back with our final segment, Big Finish on the Investigative Journal with Zvali on the Public Broadcasting Network. Okay, we're back with our final segment with Zvali, and she's telling us about her experiences 30 years with this insidious group, the Illuminati, and how deeply penetrated and infiltrated they are in our culture and in our country. Zvali, we talked about the higher levels, the mid levels you were involved in as a head trainer. How low do they go? I mean, I've said all along they're involved in gang stalking, the MK Ultra program, infiltrating truth organizations, infiltrating groups that are trying to do good. How far down do they go?
Well, they go down to the sister group level that I mentioned, and most sister groups have anywhere from usually roughly around 30 members, and those are what a lot of people would consider the... what you think of as satanic cults with the high priest and priestess, that would be the lower local level. But those people are also very active in their community. And so they will be involved in infiltrating activities when possible. Because to them, it's not infiltrating, it's helping. They think they're helping the group or helping people by becoming a member and spreading the influence.
Let me squeeze in one more caller. Roger, a faithful listener. Roger, you're on the Investigative Journal.
Yeah, thanks. I had so big a question and so little time, but maybe I just will squeeze it.
Got a couple of minutes. Yeah. Really try to work it in, Roger.
Yeah, well, you'll enjoy this first, and that is, I recall when Charlotte Iserbeat was here on the local Clear Channel radio show, and the host was, of course, dismissive of an Illuminati agenda. It was great to hear Charlotte say, "You're telling me my own father was a high..." And she, of course, was a first or second fiddle secretary at the Department of Ed. And she said, "You're telling me my own father on his deathbed was telling me, 'You go get him, girl.'" And he was one of them. And so that was great. Anyway, my question was towards the philosophical-religious motivators, if you will, which you've been dwelling on. And I've been trying to form it up into a more cohesive... integrated.
Try to make it quick. We're running out of time. Go ahead.
Yeah, to expose the ethos of the, it's like the neocons serve as the pseudo intellectual rationale for the Illuminati agenda. And I don't presume that it turns on such fine distinctions so much as it is a bare-knuckled lust for power. But everybody has sort of a worldview that's they use to justify their actions. And, of course, it's a most unconservative, humanistic, social engineering agenda on a far larger scale. And now you mentioned about these people are basically, and it's rare as hen's teeth.
Quick, Roger.
Yeah, to find somebody that's not oxymoronically both a spiritualist and occultist and also a hardcore rationalist, or maybe that's just for public consumption, right?
I know there was a question there somewhere, Roger, but anyway, thanks for calling. I only got a minute. I got to finish with Zvali. Zvali, tell us in your own words, you got about a minute or two left here. You went forward, you came forward, you're now living a life completely away from them. What's your hopes of the future in our country right now?
My hope is that people realize that this is happening and that they will start doing something about it, that they will start looking at. Now, again, we're talking about people who are immensely wealthy, so it won't be easy. But if people could rise up in prayer and just say, this isn't okay. If people become informed enough to want to learn more about it, be aware that it exists, and then possibly pray that people will take action against the things that are happening. Because
okay,
Svali,
we're all out of time. We're going to end on that prayer. I really thank you for coming forward. You're very courageous. We'll talk again, and I'll be back tomorrow on the Investigative Journal. Same time, same place.
Goodbye.